Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 16. When Callie arrived at Billy's that morning, her heart leaped into her throat when she didn't see the night volunteer's car in the driveway. She raced into the house, so intent on seeing Billy that she didn't notice the form in the sleeping bag on the floor until she gave it a good solid kick. Then she tripped over it, grabbed the table for support, got the bedpan instead, and took it to the floor with her. "Nice entrance." Joe peered at her sleepily while he rubbed his thigh. "I could have done without the kick, though." "I'm sorry," she apologized, trying not to notice that his bikini briefs had little hearts all over them. "When I didn't see a car out front, I thought something had happened to Billy." "Penn was coming down with a cold, so I told him to go home," Joe explained, helping her to her feet. "How's Billy?" She kept her eyes on Joe's rather than the rest of his body. He waited a nanosecond too long to reply. "Tell me the truth, Joe, not what you think I want to hear." He rubbed his neck, then took a deep breath. "Penn and I both think he's in a lot more pain than he wants you to know. Either that, or his condition really deteriorates at night." The words came out in a rush. "Which do you think it is?" She had to give him credit, even though he didn't want to answer that. He did. "I think he's hanging on for you." Callie studied the frail shadow of her so special friend sleeping with the dog and knew Joe was right. "There's no need for him to do that," she insisted, picking up the bedpan. "Well, then maybe it's time you tell him that." "Yes," she agreed, looking at Joe squarely. "Maybe it is." Andy stopped by later that morning. He said to check on Billy. However, it quickly became apparent to Callie that someone had asked him to check on her, too. "How are you holding up?" he asked when they sat in the kitchen drinking coffee and eating cookies after he finished examining Billy. Perhaps to dissipate their guilt, the volunteers who fell by the wayside had joined all the others in town who stopped in just long enough to drop off one food offering or another. Consequently, Billy's refrigerator now bulged with casseroles, lasagna, meatloaf, chicken pot pies, homemade baked beans, and even a small baked ham, none of which he could eat. Plates and pans filled with cookies, brownies, cobblers, and sheet cakes took up every available inch of counter space. And every day more arrived. As if by feeding the Grim Reaper, the good people of Addison hoped they might somehow keep him at bay. "I'm doing all right," she told Andy as she put another brownie on his plate. "What about Billy?" "I'm amazed he's lasted as long and as well as he has," he admitted cautiously. "If there's anything I can do to help you..." She told Andy she was fine and sent him on his way with meatloaf and pasta salad, a huge bag of cookies, and some cobbler and cake. Then rather than putter around the house, cleaning and doing other odds and ends like she usually did, she sat on Billy's bed and sorted through the last box of pictures. No matter when he awoke, he would find her there beside him. Billy only woke up once during that day, and then only briefly. She showed him the picture of himself and Joe working together that she held in her hand, but she didn't think he recognized what it was. The amount of morphine now necessary to control his pain either left him asleep or so groggy he had little awareness of his surroundings. "Don't forget the clean-out toy box," he sighed feebly, then fell asleep again. "How can I clean up my mind when you're going to die?" Her flying fingers gently caressed his sleeping form. Joe came to relieve her that evening, but she sent him away. She felt jealous of him after spending all day looking at pictures of him with Billy taken during the last 4 years. Joe's work in the woods opened up a whole new world for Billy, and Billy's happiness radiated from the pictures he took, as well as those Joe took of him. The one of Billy drinking beer and obviously checking out a woman at the pizzeria shocked her at first, but then she conceded that Joe saw a part of Billy she never knew. She and Billy had been so close for so long, she never thought of him as anything other than a part of her. She didn't remember putting the box of pictures on the floor and lying down with her arms wrapped around Billy protectively, But she bolted to instant alertness when his fitful shifting awoke her sometime after midnight. "You hurt?" She signed slowly and deliberately in the dim light cast by the bedside lamp. He reached for her hand and held it tightly. "Pain, very bad," he told her with his free hand. He continued to hold her hand and looked at her, his eyes momentarily very clear and very blue. "Hope?" She froze, not wanting to answer. He squeezed her hand tighter as a wave of pain contorted his features. When it passed, he repeated his silent question. "Hope?" She shook her head. "No hope." He looked at the clock, but unlike when they had this exchange about Nana, his next nonverbal communication came out as a statement, not a question. "It's time." When Callie stiffened, Billy disengaged his hand from hers and weakly raised it, palm facing her and fingers together. Slowly, he spread his fingers. "Let go." With tears streaming down her face, she gently gripped his hand again and nodded. "Yes." Callie had no idea how long it took for the morphine to stop Billy's pain. All she knew was that he slowly relaxed and then he died, with her arms wrapped around him and him holding her hand. Perhaps because Callie had felt like such a spectator when her parents died, she felt a certain peace as she removed Billy's IV, the pump, and the catheter, then washed him and changed his pajamas one last time. She supposed she should have called Andy to officially pronounce the death and Chucky to retrieve the body. For all she knew, there were laws that said she had to do this. But she didn't care. She knew Andy would understand, as would the local law enforcement officer. She didn't give a damn about Chucky Getz. As she did all this, she talked to Curly. But she had spent so much time with Billy that last month that she automatically signed to the dog, too. When she realized what she was doing, she spoke to him aloud. But her voice cracked, and he looked at her so oddly, she switched back to hand signals. The sun had risen by the time Callie finished packing all of Billy's medical paraphernalia in a box for Andy to dispose of, and a short time later she called a physician, the first of the necessary calls that day. He and his wife had a new baby, so she knew he'd be up by then. Next, she called Joe and Penn, and, after Andy had gone, Chucky. Chucky arrived so fast she envisioned him keeping the motor of his hearse constantly running for just such an occasion. "I take it you'll want a top-of-the-line funeral for Billy, just like his folks had," he stated rather than asked after he'd loaded Billy's body into the hearse. "You take it wrong," she corrected him. "He wanted to be cremated like my folks."
"Oh, come on, Callie. At least there'll be a memorial service in the Eternal Rest Chapel, won't there?"
he whined. "Sorry, Chucky, but Billy told me he wouldn't be caught dead there," a comment that made both Penn and Joe chuckle. "So what about a memorial service, Callie?" Penn asked after Chucky left. "Folks will be expecting something." That was Penn's way of telling her that there would be a memorial service this time. She filled a cup with coffee and sat down at the kitchen table with him and Joe. "How about we do it at the granary?" she proposed. "We could move Billy's favorite pictures there, plus there's enough food here to feed a small army. And I could set up my sound system and we could play his favorite music, too." Joe added another element she would have proposed if he hadn't. Although it sounded silly to talk about playing a deaf man's favorite music, Billy could feel with a far greater sensitivity than anyone Callie knew. And everyone in town knew he liked the feel of some music more than others. "When should we do it?" ever practical Joe said. "I'd like to do it tomorrow afternoon," she replied. "We've all been in mourning for weeks, and I think it's time for some closure. Besides, there's bad weather in the forecast for the rest of the week. You know everyone's going to want to come, and I don't want them driving under poor conditions." A third reason, which Callie didn't state, was that she needed the social part of the ritual over so she could retreat to the farm and work Billy's death through along with everything else. "It'll take some doing, but we'll get it done," Penn promised. Why don't you go home and get some rest? Joe and I will take care of it. Callie thanked him for the offer, but insisted on taking down the pictures herself. Then she made a few select calls to set the town rumor mill in motion so everyone would know about the service, beginning with Justine. "Noon tomorrow at the granary," Justine echoed Callie's words. "I know I'll be there, but I'm not sure about Bernie."
"Oh, is something wrong with him?" Callie inquired innocently.
"Dengue fever," Justine sighed heavily. "No kidding," Callie tisked sympathetically. "How did he manage to catch a tropical disease in New Hampshire?"
"Oh, you know how it is, Callie," Justine murmured pathetically, "what with global warming and all."
Callie vacillated between asking Justine to tell everyone about the memorial service versus not to tell a soul, unsure which approach would ensure the biggest turnout. In the end, she opted for honesty, maybe because honesty seemed like such a rare commodity in Justine's life. By the time she finished making her calls and getting things ready for the next day, the sun had set. All she wanted to do was go home, fix herself something to eat, and sleep with the cats. "He died and you didn't go to pieces," she congratulated herself wearily as she slowed the van to cross the bridge over the marsh. "Make it through tomorrow and you'll be home free."
You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.